She was pouting now and somehow smiling at the same time, a trick that she managed to perfection. Binet wanted to forget all about Faro and Imat and go to her right away. But if he did that, he might be an hour late for his appointment with them, which wasn't fair. 2 hours, maybe. And he had to admit to himself that he was desperately eager to know whether their calculations had confirmed his own. It was practically an even struggle. The powerful appeal of Raista on one hand, and the desire to put his mind at rest concerning a major scientific issue on the other. And though he had an obligation to be on time for his appointment, Binet realized in some confusion that he had made an appointment of sorts with Raista too, and that was a matter not only of obligation, but of delight. "Look," he said, going to the couch and taking her hand in his, "I can't be in two places at once, okay? And when I told you what I did yesterday, it had slipped my mind that Faro and Imat would be coming to the observatory to see me. But I'll make a deal with you. Let me get up there and take care of the thing with them, and then I'll skip out and be back here in a couple of hours from now. How does that sound?" "You're supposed to be photographing those asteroids this evening," she said, pouting again and not smiling at all this time. "Damn! Well, I'll ask Thalanda to do the camera work for me, or Hikkinen, or somebody. I'll be back by Onoset. That's a promise."
"A promise?"
He squeezed her hand and gave her a quick, sly grin. "One that I'll actually keep. You can bet on that, okay? You aren't angry?"
"Well,
I'll get Faro and Imat out of the way as fast as I can."
"You'd better."
As he began to assemble his papers again, she said, "What is this business with Faro and Imat that's so terribly important anyway?"
"Lab work. Gravitational studies."
"Doesn't sound all that important to me, I have to say."
"I hope it turns out not to be important to anybody," Binet replied,
"but that's something I need to find out right now." "I wish I knew what you were talking about." He glanced at his watch and took a deep breath. He could stay here another minute or two, he supposed. "You know, I've been working lately on the problem of the orbital motion of Kalgash around Onos, don't you?"
"Of course."
"All right. A couple of weeks ago, I turned up an anomaly. My orbital numbers didn't fit the theory of universal gravitation, so I checked them naturally, but they came out the same way the second time, and the third, and the fourth. Always the same anomaly, no matter what method of calculation I used."
"Oh, Binet, I'm so very sorry to hear that. You've worked so hard on this, I know, and to discover that your conclusions aren't right."
"But what if they are, though?"
"But you said, I don't know if my math is right or wrong at this point. As far as I can tell, it is. But it doesn't seem conceivable that it can be so. I've checked and checked and checked, and I get the same result each time, with all sorts of cross-checks built in to tell me that I haven't made an error in computation. But the result that I'm getting is an impossible one. The only explanation I can come up with is that I'm starting from a cockeyed assumption and doing everything else right from then on, in which case I'm going to come up with the same wrong answer no matter which method of checking my calculations I use. I might just be blind to a fundamental problem at the base of my whole set of postulates. If you start with the wrong figure for planetary mass, for instance, you'll get the wrong orbit for your planet, no matter how accurate the rest of your calculations may be. Are you following me?"
"So far, yes."
"Well, therefore, I've given the problem to Faro and Imat, without really telling them what it's all about, and I asked them to calculate the whole thing from scratch. They're bright kids. I can count on them to do decent math. And if they end up with the same conclusion I did, even though they're coming at it from an angle that completely excludes whatever error I might have built into my own line of reasoning, then I'll have to admit that my figures are right after all."
"But they can't be right, Binet. Didn't you say that your findings are contrary to the universal law of gravitation?"
"But what if the universal law is wrong, Raista?"
"What? What?" She stared at him. There was utter bewilderment in her eyes.
"You see the problem?" Binet asked. "Why I need to know right away what Imat and Faro have found?"
"No," she said. "No, I don't understand at all."
"We can talk about it later, I promise."
"Binet," half in despair,
"I've got to go, but I'll be back as fast as I can. It's a promise, Raista, a promise."
5. Zafira paused only long enough to snatch a pick and a brush from the equipment tent, which had been knocked askew by the sandstorm but was still reasonably intact. Then she went scrambling up the side of the hill of Thambo with Balik ponderously hauling himself right behind her. Young Ilis 18 had appeared from the shelter by the cliff now, and he stood below staring up at them.
Thuvik and his corps of workmen were a little farther back, watching, scratching their heads in puzzlement.
"Watch out!"
Sephira called to Balik when she had reached the beginning of the open gouge in the hill that the sandstorm had carved. "I'm going to run a trial cut."
"Shouldn't we photograph it first and..."
"I told you to watch out," she said sharply as she dug her pick into the hillside and set a shower of loose soil tumbling down onto his head and shoulders. He jumped aside, spitting out sand.
"Sorry,"
she said without looking down. She cut into the hillside a second time, widening the storm gouge. It wasn't the best of technique, she knew, to be slashing away like this. Her mentor, grand old Shelbik, was probably whirling in his grave. And the founder of their science, the revered Galdo 221, no doubt, was looking down from his exalted place in the pantheon of archaeologists and shaking his head sadly. On the other hand, Shelbik and Galdo had had chances of their own to uncover whatever lay in the Hill of Thombo, and they hadn't done it. If she was a little too excited now, a little too hasty in her attack, well, they would simply have to forgive her. Now that the seeming calamity of the sandstorm had been transformed into serendipitous good fortune, now that the apparent ruination of her career had turned unexpectedly into the making of it, Sephira could not hold herself back from finding out what was buried here. Could not. Absolutely could not.
"Look," she muttered, knocking a great mass of overburden away and going to work with her brush. "We've got a charred layer right here, right at the foundation level of the Cyclopean city. The place must have burned clear down to the stone. But you look a little lower on the hill and you can see that the crosshatch-style town is sitting right under the fire line. The Cyclopean people simply plunked this whole monumental foundation down on top of the older city."
"Sephira," said Balik uneasily.
I know, but let me at least begin to see what's here. Just a quick probe now, and then we can go back to doing things the proper way."
She felt as though she were perspiring from head to toe. Her eyes were starting to wake, so fiercely was she staring.
"Look, will you? We're way up on top of the hill, and we've already got two towns. And it's my guess that if we unzip the mound a little further, someplace around where we'd expect to find the foundations of the crosshatch people, we'll..."
Yes,
there! By darkness, will you look at that, Balik? Just look!"
She pointed triumphantly with the tip of her pick. Another dark line of charcoal was apparent near the foundations of the crosshatch-style building. The second highest level had also been destroyed by fire, just as the Cyclopean one had. And from the way things looked, it was sitting atop the ruins of an even older village. Balik now had caught her fervor, too. Together they worked to lay bare the outer face of the hill, midway between ground level and the shattered summit. Ilus called up to them to ask what on Kalgash they were doing, but they ignored him. Aflame with eagerness and curiosity, they cut swiftly through the ancient packing of windblown sand, moving 3 inches farther down the hill. 6, 8.
"Do you see what I see?"
Sephira cried after a time.
"Another village, yes. But what kind of style of architecture is that, would you say?"
She shrugged.
"It's a new one on me."
"And me too. Something very archaic, that's for sure."
"No question of it. But I think it's not the most archaic thing we've got here. Not by plenty." Sephira peered down toward the distant ground.
"You know what I think, Balik? We've got 5 towns here. 6, 7, maybe 8. Each one right on top of the next. You and I may spend the rest of our lives digging in this hill."
They looked at each other in wonder.
"We'd better get down and take some photos now," he said quietly.
Yes, we'd better do that."
She felt almost calm suddenly. Enough of this furious hacking and slashing, she thought. It was time to go back to being a professional now. Time to approach this hill like a scholar, not a treasure hunter or a journalist. Let Balik take his photographs first from every side, then take the soil samples at the surface level, and put in the first marker stakes, and go through all the rest of the standard preliminary procedures. Then a trial trench, a bold shaft right through the hill to give us some idea of what we've really got here. And then, she told herself, we'll peel this hill layer by layer. We'll take it apart, carving away each stratum to look at the one below it, until we're down to virgin soil. And by the time we're done with that, she vowed, we'll know more about the prehistory of Kalgash than all my predecessors put together have been able to learn since archaeologists first came here to Beklemont to dig.
6.
Kalaritan said,
We've arranged everything for your inspection of the Tunnel of Mystery, Dr. Sheeran. If you'll be down in front of your hotel in about an hour, our car will pick you up.
Right, Sheeran said. See you in about an hour. The plump psychologist put down the phone and stared solemnly at himself in the mirror opposite his bed. The face that looked back at him was a troubled one. He seemed so wasted and haggard that he tugged at his cheeks to assure himself that they were still there. Yes, there they were, his familiar fleshy cheeks. He hadn't lost an ounce. The haggardness was all in his mind. Sheeran had slept badly, had scarcely slept at all, so it seemed to him now. And yesterday he had only picked at his food, nor did he feel in the least hungry now. The thought of going downstairs for breakfast had no appeal whatever. That was an alien concept to him, not to feel hungry. Was the bleakness of his mood, he wondered, the result of his interviews with Clariton's hapless patients yesterday? Or was he simply terrified of going through the Tunnel of Mystery? Certainly, seeing those three patients hadn't been easy. It was a long time since he'd done any actual clinical work, and obviously his sojourn among the academics at Sorrow University had attenuated the professional detachment that allows members of the healing arts to confront the ill without being overwhelmed by compassion and sorrow. Sheeran was surprised at that, how tender-hearted he seemed to have become, how thin-skinned. That first one, Harim, the longshoreman, he looked tough enough to withstand anything. And yet 15 minutes of darkness on his trip through the Tunnel of Mystery had reduced him to such a state that merely to relive the trauma in memory sent him into babbling hysteria. How terribly sad that was. And then the other two, in the afternoon, they had been in even worse shape. Justine, 190, the schoolteacher, that lovely, frail woman with the dark, intelligent eyes. She hadn't been able to stop sobbing for a moment. And though she was able to speak clearly and well, at least in the beginning, her story had degenerated into mere incoherent blurtings within a few sentences. And Chimelet 97, the high school athlete, obviously a perfect physical specimen. Sheeran wasn't going quickly to forget how the boy had reacted to the sight of the afternoon sky when Sheeran opened the blinds in his room. There was Onos blazing away in the west, and all that huge, handsome boy could manage to say was, "The darkness. The darkness." Before he turned away and tried to scuttle down under his bed. The darkness. The darkness. And now, Sheeran thought gloomily, it's my turn to take a ride in the Tunnel of Mystery. Of course, he could simply refuse. There was nothing in his consulting contract with the municipality of Jonglor that required him to risk his sanity. He'd be able to render a valid enough opinion without actually sticking his neck into peril. But something in him rebelled at such timidity. His professional pride, if nothing else, was pushing him toward the tunnel. He was here to study the phenomenon of mass hysteria, and to help these people work out ways not only of healing the present victims, but of preventing recurrences of these tragedies. How could he deign to explain what had happened to the tunnel's victims if he didn't make a close study of the cause of their disturbances? He had to. It would be sheer malfeasance to back out. Nor did he want anyone, not even these strangers here in Jonglor, to be able to accuse him of cowardice. He remembered the taunts of his childhood. "Fatty is a coward, Fatty is a coward," all because he hadn't wanted to climb a tree that was obviously beyond the capabilities of his heavy, ill-coordinated body. But Fatty wasn't a coward. Sheeran knew that. He was content with himself, a sane, well-balanced man. He simply didn't want other people making incorrect assumptions about him because of his unheroic appearance. Besides, fewer than 1 out of 10 of those who had gone through the Tunnel of Mystery had come out of it showing any symptoms of emotional disturbance. And those people must have been vulnerable in some special way. Precisely because he was so sane, Sheeran told himself, because he was so well balanced, he had nothing to fear. Nothing to fear. He kept repeating those words to himself until he felt almost calm. Even so, Sheeran was something other than his customary jolly self as he went downstairs to wait for the hospital car to pick him up. Clariton was there, and Cubello, and a striking-looking woman named Verita 312, who was introduced to him as one of the engineers who had designed the tunnel.
Sheeran greeted them all with hearty handshakes and a broad smile that he hoped seemed convincing. "A nice day for a trip to the amusement park," he said, trying to sound jovial. Clariton looked at him oddly.
"I'm glad you feel that way. Did you sleep well, Dr. Sheeran?"
"Oh, very well, thanks. As well as could be expected, I should say, after seeing those unhappy people yesterday." Cubello said,
"You aren't optimistic about the chances of recovery, then?"
"I'd like to be," Sheeran told the lawyer ambiguously. The car moved smoothly down the street.
"It's about a 20-minute drive to the Centennial Exposition Grounds," Clariton said. "The exposition itself will be crowded. It is every day. But we've had a big section of the amusement area roped off, so that we won't be disturbed. The Tunnel of Mystery itself, as you know, has been shut down since the full extent of the troubles became apparent."
"You mean the deaths?"
"Obviously, we couldn't allow the ride to remain open after that," Cubello said. "But you must realize that we were considering shutting down much earlier. It was a question of determining whether the people who appeared to have been disturbed by their trips through the tunnel were actually suffering harm or were merely falling in with popular hysteria."
"Of course," Sheeran said, his tone a dry one. "The city council wouldn't have wanted to close down such a profitable attraction except for a really good reason, such as having a bunch of customers drop dead from fright, I suppose." The atmosphere in the car became exceedingly chilly. Clariton said after a time,
"The tunnel was not only a profitable attraction, but also one that nearly everyone who attended the exposition was eager to experience, Dr. Sheeran. I understand that thousands of people had to be turned away every day."
"Even though it was obvious from the very first day that some of those who rode through the tunnel, like Harim and his family, were coming out of it in psychotic states?"
"Especially because of that, Doctor," Cubello said.
"What?"
"Forgive me if I seem to be explaining your own specialty to you," the lawyer said unctuously, "but I'd like to remind you that there's a fascination in being frightened when it's part of a game. A baby is born with three instinctive fears: of loud noises, of falling, and of the total absence of light. That's why it's considered so funny to jump at someone and shout boo. That's why it's such fun to ride a roller coaster. And that's why the Tunnel of Mystery was something everybody wanted to see at first hand. People came out of that darkness shaking, breathless, half dead with fear, but they kept on paying to get in. The fact that a few of those who took the ride came out of it in a rather intense state of shock only added to the appeal."
"Because most people assumed that they'd be tough enough to withstand whatever it was that had shaken up the others so much, is that it?"
"Exactly, Doctor."
"And when some of the people came out not just highly upset, but actually dead of fright? Even if the exposition managers couldn't see their way clear to shutting the thing down after that, I'd imagine that potential customers would have become few and far between once the news of the deaths got around."
"Oh, quite the contrary," said Cubello, smiling triumphantly. "The same psychological mechanism operated, though even more strongly. After all, if people with weak hearts wanted to go through the tunnel, it was at their own risk. Why be surprised at what happened to them? The city council discussed the whole thing at great length, and finally agreed to put a doctor in the front office, and have every customer undergo a physical examination before getting into the car. That actually boosted ticket sales."
"In that case," Sheeran said, "why is the tunnel shut down now? From what you've told me, I'd expect it to be doing terrific business. Lines stretching from Jonglore all the way to Kunabar. Mobs of people going in the front way and a steady stream of corpses being hauled out the back."
"Dr. Sheeran!"
"Well, why isn't it still open? If even the deaths didn't trouble anyone."
"The liability insurance problem," Cubello said.
"Ah, of course."
"Despite your grisly little turn of phrase just now, actual deaths were very few and far between. Three, I think, or maybe five. The families of those who passed away were given adequate indemnities, and the cases were closed. What ultimately became a problem for us was not the death rate, but the survival rate among those who underwent traumatic disturbance. It began to become clear that some might require hospitalization for prolonged periods, an ongoing expense, a constant financial drain on the municipality and its insurers."
"I see," Sheeran said morosely.
If they simply fall down dead, it's a one-shot cost. Buy off the relatives, and that's that. But if they linger for months or years in a public institution, the price can get to be too high.
Perhaps a little harshly put, said Gubello, but that is essentially the calculation the city council was forced to make.
Dr. Sheeran seems a little testy this morning, Clariton said to the lawyer. Possibly the idea of going through the tunnel himself is troublesome to him.
Absolutely not, said Sheeran at once.
Of course, you understand that there is no real necessity for you to...
There is, Sheeran said. There was silence in the car. Sheeran peered somberly at the changing landscape, the curious, angular, scaly-barked trees, the bushes with flowers of odd metallic hues, the peculiarly high and narrow houses with pointed eaves. He had rarely been this far north before. There was something very disagreeable about the look of the entire province, and about this crew of mealy-mouthed, cynical people, too. He told himself that he'd be glad to get home to sorrow again. But first, the Tunnel of Mystery. The Jongleur Centennial Exposition was spread over a vast area of parkland just east of the city. It was a mini-city in itself, and quite spectacular in its own way, Sheeran thought. He saw fountains, arcades, shining pink and turquoise towers of iridescent stone-hard plastic. Great exhibit halls offered art treasures from every province of Calgash, industrial displays, the latest scientific marvels. Wherever he looked, there was something unusual and beautiful to engage his eye. Thousands of people, perhaps hundreds of thousands, strolled its glittering, elegant boulevards and avenues. Sheeran had always heard that the Jongleur Centennial Exposition was one of the marvels of the world, and he saw now that it was true. To be able to visit it was a rare privilege. It was open only once every 100 years for a 3-year run to commemorate the anniversary of the city's founding, and this, Jongleur's 5th Centennial Exposition, was said to be the greatest of all. Indeed, he felt a sudden buoyant excitement, such as he had not known in a long while, as he traveled through its well-manicured grounds. He hoped that he'd have some time later in the week to explore it on his own. But his mood changed abruptly as the car swung around the perimeter of the exposition and brought them to an entrance in back that led to the amusement area. Here, just as Clariton had said, great sections were roped off, and sullen crowds peered across the ropes in obvious annoyance as Gubello, Clariton, and Verita 312 led him toward the Tunnel of Mystery. Sheeran could hear them muttering angrily, a low, harsh growling that he found unsettling and even a little intimidating. He realized that the lawyer had told the truth. These people were angry because the tunnel was closed. They're jealous, Sheeran thought in wonder. They know we're going to the tunnel, and they want to go too, despite everything that's happened there.
We can go in this way, Verita said.
The facade of the tunnel was an enormous pyramidal structure, tapering away at the sides in an eerie, dizzying perspective. In the center of it was a huge, six-sided entrance gate, dramatically outlined in scarlet and gold. Bars had been drawn across it. Verita produced a key and unlocked a small door to the left of the facade, and they stepped through. Inside, everything seemed much more ordinary. Sheeran saw a series of metal railings, no doubt designed to contain the lines of people waiting to board the ride. Beyond that was a platform, much like that in any railway station, with a string of small open cars waiting there. And beyond that, darkness.
Gubello said, "If you don't mind signing this first, please, doctor."
Sheeran stared at the paper the lawyer had handed him. It was full of words, blurred, dancing about.
"What's this?"
"A release, the standard form."
"Yes, of course." Airily, Sheeran scrawled his name without even trying to read the paper. "You are not afraid," he told himself. "You fear nothing at all." Verita 312 put a small device in his hand. "An abort switch," she explained. "The full ride lasts 15 minutes, but you just have to press this green panel here as soon as you've been inside long enough to have learned what you need to know. Or, in case you begin to feel uncomfortable, and lights will come on, your car will go quickly to the far end of the tunnel and circle back to the station."
"Thank you," Sheeran said. "I doubt that I'll need it."
"But you should have it just in case." "It's my plan to experience the ride to the fullest," he told her, enjoying his own pomposity. But there was such a thing as foolhardiness, he reminded himself.
He didn't intend to use the abort switch, but it was probably unwise not to take it. Just in case. He stepped out on the platform. Polariton and Cubello were looking at him in an all-too-transparent way. He could practically hear them thinking, "This fat old fool is going to turn to jelly in there." Well, let them think it. Verita had disappeared. No doubt she had gone to turn on the tunnel mechanism. Yes, there she was now, in a control booth high up to the right, signaling that everything was ready.
"If you'll board the car, Doctor,"
Polariton said. "Of course, of course." Fewer than 1 out of 10 experienced harmful effects. Very likely they were unusually vulnerable to darkness disorders to begin with. I am not. I am a very stable individual. He entered the car. There was a safety belt. He strapped it around his waist, adjusting it with some difficulty to his girth. The car began to roll forward. Slowly. Very slowly. Darkness was waiting for him. Fewer than 1 out of 10. Fewer than 1 out of 10. He understood the darkness syndrome. That would protect him, he was sure. His understanding. Even though all of mankind had an instinctive fear of the absence of light, that did not mean that the absence of light was of itself harmful. What was harmful, Shirin knew, was one's reaction to the absence of light. The thing to do is to stay calm. Darkness is nothing but darkness, a change of external circumstances. We are conditioned to abhor it because we live in a world where darkness is unnatural, where there is always light, the light of the many suns. At any time, there might be as many as 4 suns shining at once. Usually, there were 3 in the sky, and at no time were there ever less than 2. And the light of any of them was sufficient all by itself to hold back the darkness. The darkness. The darkness. The darkness. Shirin was in the tunnel now. Behind him, the last vestige of light disappeared, and he peered into an utter void. There was nothing ahead of him. Nothing. A pit. An abyss. A zone of total lightlessness. And he was tumbling headlong into it. He felt sweat breaking out all over him. His knees began to shake. His forehead throbbed. He held up his hand and was unable to see it in front of his face.
"Abort! Abort! Abort! Abort!"
"No, absolutely not." He sat upright, back rigid, eyes wide open, gazing stolidly into the nothingness through which he plunged. On and on, ever deeper. Primordial fears bubbled and hissed in the depths of his soul, and he forced them back down and away. "The suns are still shining outside the tunnel," he told himself. "This is only temporary. In 14 minutes and 30 seconds, I'll be back out there." 14 minutes and 20 seconds. 14 minutes and 10 seconds. 14 minutes... Was he moving at all, though? He couldn't tell. Maybe he wasn't. The car's mechanism was silent and he had no reference points. "What if I'm stuck?" he wondered. "Just sitting here in the dark. No way to tell where I am. What's happening? How much time is passing? 15 minutes? 20? Half an hour? Until I've passed whatever limit my sanity can stand, and then... There's always the abort switch, though. But suppose it doesn't work? What if I press it and the lights don't come on? I could test it, I suppose, just to see.
Fatty is a coward. Fatty is a coward.
No, no, don't touch it. Once you turn the lights on, you won't be able to turn them off again. You mustn't use the abort switch or they'll know. They'll all know.
Fatty is a coward. Fatty is a coward.
Suddenly, astonishingly, he hurled the abort switch into the darkness. There was a tiny sound as it fell somewhere. Then silence again. His hand felt terribly empty. The darkness. The darkness. There was no end to it. He was tumbling through an infinite abyss, falling and falling and falling into the night, the endless night, the all-devouring black. Breathe deeply. Stay calm. What if there's permanent mental damage? Stay calm, he told himself. You'll be all right. You've got maybe 11 minutes more of this at the worst. Maybe only 6 or 7. The suns are shining out there. 6 or 7 minutes and you'll never be in darkness again. Not if you live to be 1,000. The darkness. Oh, God, the darkness. Calm, calm. You're a very stable man, Sheeran. You're extremely sane. You were sane when you went into this thing, and you'll be sane when you come out. Tick, tick, tick. Every second gets you closer to the exit. Or does it? This ride may never end. I could be in here forever. Tick, tick, tick. Am I moving? Do I have 5 minutes left or 5 seconds? Or is this still the first minute? Tick, tick. Why don't they let me out? Can't they tell how I'm suffering in here? They don't want to let you out. They'll never let you out. They're going to... Suddenly, a stabbing pain between his eyes, an explosion of agony in his skull. What's that? Light! Could it be? Yes, yes, thank God, light, yes! Like any god that might ever have existed. He was at the end of the tunnel. He was coming back to the station. It must be, yes, yes. His heartbeat, which had become a panicky thunder, was starting to return to normal. His eyes, adjusting now to the return of normal conditions, began to focus on familiar things. Blessed things. The stanchions, the platform, the little window in the control booth. Kubello, Hilariton, watching him. He felt ashamed now of his cowardice. Pull yourself together, Sheeran. It wasn't so bad, really. You're all right. You aren't lying in the bottom of the car, sucking your thumb and whimpering. It was scary. It was terrifying, but it didn't destroy you. It wasn't actually anything you couldn't handle.
Here we go. Give us your hand, Doctor. Up. Up.
They hauled him to a standing position and steadied him as he clambered out of the car. Sheeran sucked breath deep down into his lungs. He ran his hand across his forehead, wiping away the streaming perspiration.
The little abort switch, he murmured. I seem to have lost it somewhere.
How are you, Doctor?
Clariton asked.
How was it?
Sheeran teetered. The hospital director caught him by the arm, steadying him, but Sheeran indignantly brushed him away. He wasn't going to let them think that those few minutes in the tunnel had gotten to him. But he couldn't deny that he had been affected. Try as he might, there was no way to hide that. Not even from himself. No force in the world could ever get him to take a second trip through that tunnel, he realized.
Doctor! Doctor!
I'm all right, he said thickly.
He says he's all right, came the lawyer's voice. Stand back. Let him alone.
His legs are wobbling, Clariton said. He's going to fall.
No, Sheeran said. Not a chance. I'm fine, I tell you.
He lurched and staggered, regained his balance, lurched again. Sweat poured from every pore he had. He glanced over his shoulder, saw the mouth of the tunnel, and shuddered. Turning away from that dark cave, he pulled his shoulders up high, as if he would have liked to hide his face between them.
Doctor?
Clariton said doubtfully. No use pretending. This was foolishness, this vain and stubborn attempt at heroism. Let them think he was a coward. Let them think anything. Those 15 minutes had been the worst nightmare of his life. The impact of it was still sinking in and sinking in and sinking in. It was powerful stuff, he said. Very powerful. Very disturbing.
But you're basically all right, isn't that so?
The lawyer said eagerly.
A little shaken, yes. Who wouldn't be? Going into darkness. But basically okay. As we knew you'd be. It's only a few, a very few, who undergo any sort of harmful...
No, Sheeran said.
The lawyer's face was like that of a grinning gargoyle in front of him, like the face of a demon. He couldn't bear the sight of it. But a good dose of the truth would exorcise the demon. No need to be diplomatic, Sheeran thought, not when talking with demons. It's impossible for anyone to go through that thing without being at grave risk. I'm certain of it now. Even the strongest psyche will take a terrible battering, and the weak ones will simply crumble. If you open that ride again, you'll have every mental hospital in 4 provinces full up within 6 months.
On the contrary, Doctor.
Don't on the contrary me. Have you been in the tunnel, Kubello? No, I didn't think so. But I have. You're paying for my professional opinion. You might as well have it right now. The tunnel's deadly. It's a simple matter of human nature. Darkness is more than most of us can handle, and that's never going to change, so long as we've got a sun left burning in the sky. Shut the tunnel down for good, Kubello. In the name of sanity, man, shut the thing down.
Shut it down!
7.
Parking his motor scooter in the faculty lot just below the observatory dome, Binet went jogging quickly up the footpath that led to the main entrance of the huge building. As he began to ascend the wide stone steps of the entranceway itself, he was startled to hear someone calling his name from above.
"Binet, so you are here, after all."
The astronomer looked up. The tall, heavy-set, powerful figure of his friend Theremin 762 of the Sorrow City Chronicle stood framed in the great door of the observatory.
"Theremin? Were you looking for me?"
"I was, but they told me you weren't due to show up here for another couple of hours. And then, just as I was leaving, there you were anyway. Talk about serendipity." Binet trotted up the last few steps, and they gave each other a quick hug. He had known the newspaper man some 3 or 4 years, ever since the time Theremin had come to the observatory to interview some scientist, any scientist, about the latest manifesto of the Crackpot Apostles of Flame group. Gradually, he and Theremin had become close friends, even though Theremin was some 5 years older and came out of a rougher, worldlier background. Binet liked the idea of having a friend who had no involvement whatsoever in university politics, and Theremin was delighted to know someone who wasn't at all interested in exploiting him for his considerable journalistic influence.
"Is something wrong?" Binet asked.
"Not in the least. But I need to get you to do the Voice of Science routine again. Mondior's made another of his famous repent, repent, doom is coming speeches. Now he says he's able to reveal the exact hour when the world will be destroyed. In case you're interested, it's going to happen next year on the 19th of Theptar, as a matter of fact."
"That madman! It's a waste of space printing anything about him. Why does anyone pay the slightest bit of attention to the apostles anyway?"
Theremin shrugged. "The fact is that people do. A lot of people, Binet. And if Mondior says the end is nigh, I need to get someone like you to stand up and say, 'Not so, brothers and sisters, have no fear, all is well,' or words to that effect. I can count on you, can't I, Binet?"
"You know you can."
"This evening?"
"This evening? Oh, Lord, Theremin, this evening's a real mess. How much of my time do you think you'd have to have?"
"Half an hour, 45 minutes.
"Look," Binet said, "I've got an urgent appointment right now. That's why I'm here ahead of schedule. After that, I've sworn to Raista that I'll hustle back home and devote, well, an hour or two to her. We've been on such different tracks lately that we've hardly seen each other at all. And then later in the evening, I'm supposed to be here at the observatory again to supervise taking a bunch of photographs of..."
"All right," said Theremin. "I see I've picked the wrong time for this."
"Well, listen, no problem, Binet. I've got until tomorrow afternoon to turn in my story. What if we talk in the morning?"
"The morning?" Binet said doubtfully. "I know morning's an unthinkable concept for you, but what I mean is, I can get back up here at Onos Rise just as you're finishing up your evening's work. If you could simply manage a little interview with me before you go home to go to sleep."
"Well,
for a friend, Binet?" Binet gave the journalist a weary look.
"Of course I will. That's not the issue. It's just that I may be so groggy after a whole evening of work that I may not be of any use to you."
Theremin grinned. "That doesn't worry me. I've noticed that you're capable of de-groggifying pretty damn quickly when there's anti-scientific nonsense for you to refute. Tomorrow at Onos Rise, then? In your office upstairs?"
"Right."
"A million thanks, pal. I'll owe you one for this."
"Don't mention it."
Theremin saluted and began to head down the steps. "Give my best to that beautiful lady of yours," he called. "And I'll see you in the morning."
"See you in the morning, yes," Binet echoed.
How odd that sounded. He never saw anybody or anything in the morning. But he'd make an exception for Theremin. That was what friendship was all about, wasn't it? Binet turned and entered the observatory. Inside, all was dimly lit and calm, the familiar hush of the Great Hall of Science, where he had spent most of his time since his early university days. But the calm was, he knew, a deceptive one. This mighty building, like the more mundane places of the world, was constantly a swirl with conflicts of all sorts, ranging from the loftiest of philosophical disputes down to the pettiest of trivial feuds, spats, and backbiting intrigues. Astronomers, as a group, were no more virtuous than anyone else. All the same, the observatory was a sanctuary for Binet and for most of the others who worked there, a place where they could leave most of the world's problems behind and devote themselves more or less peacefully to the everlasting struggle to answer the great questions that the universe posed. He walked swiftly down the main hall, trying as always, without success, to muffle the clatter of his boots against the marble floor. As he invariably did, he glanced quickly into the display cases along the wall, to the right and left, where some of the sacred artifacts of the history of astronomy were on perpetual exhibit. Here were the crude, almost comical telescopes that such pioneers as Chector and Stanta had used 400 or 500 years before. Here were the gnarled black lumps of meteorites that had fallen from the sky over the centuries, enigmatic reminders of the mysteries that lay behind the clouds. Here were the first editions of the great astronomical sky charts and textbooks, and the time-yellowed manuscripts of some of the epoch-making theoretical works of the great thinkers. Binet paused for a moment before the last of those manuscripts, which, unlike the others, seemed fresh and almost new. For it was only a single generation old. Athor 77's classic codification of the theory of universal gravitation, worked out not very long before Binet himself had been born. Though he was not a particularly religious man, Binet stared at that thin sheaf of paper with something very much like reverence, and found himself thinking something very much like a prayer. The theory of universal gravitation was one of the pillars of the cosmos for him, perhaps the most basic pillar. He couldn't imagine what he would do if that pillar were to fall, and it seemed to him now that the pillar might be tottering. At the end of the hall, behind a handsome bronze door, was Dr. Athor's own office. Binet glanced at it quickly and hurried past it, up the stairs. The venerable and still formidable observatory director was the last person in the world, absolutely the last, that Binet wanted to see at this moment. Faro and Emot were waiting for him upstairs in the chart room, where they had arranged to meet. "I'm sorry I'm a little late," Binet said. "It's been a complicated afternoon so far." They gave him nervous, owlish smiles. What a strange pair they are, he thought, not for the first time. They both came from some backwater farming province, Sithen, maybe, or Gatamber. Faro 24 was short and roly-poly, with a languid, almost indolent way of moving. His general style was easygoing and casual. His friend Emot 70 was incredibly tall and thin, something like a hinged ladder with arms and legs and a face, and you practically needed a telescope to see his head looming up there in the stratosphere above you. Emot was as tense and twitchy as his friend was relaxed, yet they were inseparable, always had been. Of all the young graduate students, one notch down the observatory's table of organization from Binet's level, they were by far the most brilliant.
"We haven't been waiting long," Emot said at once.
"Only a minute or two, Dr. Binet," Faro added.
"Not quite doctor yet, thanks," Binet said. "I've still got the final inquisition to go through. How did you manage with those computations?"
Emot said, twitching and jerking his impossibly long legs around.
"This is gravitational stuff, isn't it, sir?"
Faro nudged him so vigorously in the ribs with his elbow that Binet expected to hear the sound of crunching bone.
"That's all right," Binet said. "Emot's correct, as a matter of fact." He gave the tall young man a pale smile. "I wanted this to be a purely abstract mathematical exercise for you. But it doesn't surprise me that you were able to figure out the context. You figured it out after you had your result, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Emot and Faro at the same time. "We ran all the calculations first," Faro said.
"Then we took a second look and the context became apparent," said Emot.
"Ah, yes," Binet said. "These kids were sometimes a little unnerving. They were so young, only 6 or 7 years younger than he, as a matter of fact, but he was an assistant professor and they were students, and to him and them both, that was a vast barrier. Young as they were, though, they had such extraordinary minds." He wasn't altogether pleased that they had guessed at the conceptual matrix within which these calculations were located. In fact, he wasn't pleased at all. In another few years, they'd be right up here on the faculty with him, perhaps competing for the same professorship he hoped to get, and that might not be fun. But he tried not to think about that. He reached for their printout. "May I see?" he asked. Hands fluttering wildly, Emot handed it over. Binet scanned the rows of figures, calmly at first, then with rising agitation. He had been pondering all year long certain implications of the theory of universal gravitation.